part of our time together this afternoon. One of the things that I think is really beneficial is to have questions that people have related to the subjects that we've been considering answered, or at least addressed, or at least told, I don't know. So, I want to give you an opportunity right now to ask a question. If you've got anything about some of the things that we considered yesterday, you know, with the fish, the horses, if you've got even questions further on in the week, as far as, you know, we only went through even part of day one, but if you've got some questions and you figure you might not get to it, or I would really be happy to try and interact with you on some of those things. So, I don't want to spend too much time in silence here. So, if you've got a question, probably some others do too. Would you ask it? Yes, Lloyd. I did not plant this question. I have a suitcase here full of books. And since, you know, it's a wonderful problem that you've got, there's no room to even set a table up somewhere. Now, I don't sell books, but having resources is really an important thing. And so let me recommend a few. This one I have just learned about, and I'm really impressed with it. I'm not even familiar with the group or persons that put it together, but this is, I would call, a resource book. It's something where it's got a really good index, and so you've got a question about a particular thing, you go in the back. This is not a book you're going to sit down and read from cover to cover. It's called The Evolution Cruncher. The Evolution Cruncher by the author here, but I'm sure that Vance didn't put this whole thing together, at least I don't think so. Vance Farrell. Evolution Facts Incorporated. The Evolution Cruncher. I highly recommend that as a book that you could use as a reference tool. You just look up in the back for your questions, and it's really small print, and it's big and fat. And the questions that I've had and then looked up, it was really helpful. So there's one good one. This would be, you know, evidence stuff. Not biblical things, per se, but more just on evolution, quote-unquote, facts, and reputation of them. Now, this is a little simpler. Maybe some of you have seen this one before, heard of it, by Jonathan Sarfati, forward in it by Ken Ham, called Refuting Evolution. And this was written in direct response to another book that was written about why evolution is so correct and everything should be taught in the public schools. So that one isn't near as complete as The Evolution Cruncher. It is a book that you probably won't be able to find. But it's still so excellent, I'll point it out to you, because if you ever do have a chance, you could buy it and let me know, and I'll take it off your hands for a hefty finder's fee. Because it's not in print anymore. It's by William R. Fix, F-I-X. It's called The Bone Peddlers, Selling Evolution. And it is the best book I have ever come across on anthropology. That's human evolution, anthropology. And this man is not a believer. And yet he slices and dices and disposes of the current field of human anthropology like I've never seen or heard anyone. It goes through all the hoaxes, all the frauds, and essentially the title here, the subtitle, explains sort of his approach. The Bone Peddlers Selling Evolution. And what he does is expose that essentially, unfortunately, especially in this area of human evolution, anthropology, you know, Lucy and Australopithecus and Afarensis and all those guys that you're told are your late great 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 grandpas, he demonstrates how fraught with error and deceit that whole scenario is. So if you can get your hands on this book and are especially interested in human evolution, this is terrific. But it might be pretty tough to find. The Creation Research Society publishes a quarterly technical journal, and there's really interesting articles in there. You know, one of the criticisms that the secular scientific community has of creationists is they don't do any research. They don't write anything technical. They just blather about, you know, ephemeral stuff and quote Bible verses. Well, that's not the case. There are many good scientists, and I want to maybe correct an impression that I've given sometimes as I've talked here, that like all the scientists believe in evolution and so forth. There are a large body, and it's growing, of fine Christians who are scientists, and they're doing good research, and this is this particular journal is a real, I highly recommend it. It's got technical articles in it, but not that technical. It's readable. So CRSQ, the Creation Research Quarterly, if you're interested in getting a journal that keeps you up to date on the newest things in creation science. Here's another book, Darwin's Black Box, by Michael Bay. He's a biochemist, and that's what I am. And so it really gets into some interesting issues about how the complexity of life couldn't have evolved. You've got to have all these working parts all working together at one time for the simplest cell to function. And that's quite popular. Have anybody heard of this one? Yeah, good. Okay. Now here's one that's got great pictures in it. And I like pictures as much as the next person. It's called The Amazing Story of Creation from Science and the Bible. Now it's written more at a junior high, maybe a high school level. But, I mean, I enjoy reading it, and there's really neat stuff in there. So I wouldn't be ashamed if I were you to get it. So it's by Duane Gish, and you have seen this book. This is probably popular. I highly recommend it too. It's excellent. This is from a creationist perspective with Bible stuff in it. All right. This is not even from a Christian. Darwin's Black Box is not from a creationist point of view. A lot of these books that I'm pointing out are the kind of books that you know the kind of person. Well, you know, what about? I'm willing to read some things that criticize evolution, but I don't want anything about the Bible in there. Like, as if there's a Bible verse, well, that excludes it from being scientific. I mean, that's the common concept of so many people. Well, there are a lot of good books out there that will just refute evolution, but don't let that stop you from quoting Bible verses, just like Darwin did in his naivete. You know, go ahead and just, the Holy Spirit will use those verses, even if that person is denying it. And so, this book also, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Michael Denton. This is a fairly popular book. It, again, is not written from a creationist perspective, but he does an excellent job of criticizing many aspects of evolution. Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, Michael Denton. And I'll point out one more. This is essentially about astronomy. Okay? Space. Show Me God by Fred Heeren. H-E-E-R-E-N. And he has some really amazing insights into the development of astronomy and theory of relativity and things like that. And so I highly recommend this one as well. He challenges some of the dogma of evolutionary science when it comes from the perspective of how the universe formed and all of that. All right? I guess I shouldn't forget this one. This is basically the foundational book of creation science. It's called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. And it is technical in some places, but if you wanted to start, this is I would consider this book, you guys, to be as important a book as The Origin of Species when it comes to science in the 20th century. The Origin of Species was written in the 19th century. This was written in the 20th. And this really formed the whole foundation of a creation science movement which is really, really growing. And so that's an answer to your question, brother. Thanks for asking it. Yes. God said, "Heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. So where is the house that you could build for me?" So I would, from God's word, assess that the reason God put that fantastic expanse of starry galaxies out there was simply for a place to sit down. I'll explain that a little bit more. I mean, imagine that. God says heaven is his throne. It's a place for him to sit down. God is that vast and that great. And so as fantastic and as far-flung as we can ever, you know, polish up our telescopes and see out there, you know, we just recognize that's just God's throne room. I think it truly is for declaring the glory of God. You know, Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and their expanse declares the work of His hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. It's just for man's benefit to get a glimpse of how vast and majestic God truly is. You know, there's a popular movie called Contact, written by Carl Sagan. He was the one who wrote the book. And then they made the movie with Jodie Foster. And, you know, this was sort of like Carl Sagan's legacy. This book really explained his life's story or life's meaning. And there was a little line throughout that movie. They would say, well, do you think there's anything out there? And you go, well, if there isn't, it's an awful waste of space. Like as if, well, since it's so big, there just must be something up there because it would waste space. Well, that's not God's perspective from His Word. He says that it declares His glory. The center of God's attention is on this earth where human beings reside. And the rest of it is not irrelevant by any means, but God doesn't tell us that He's got any other plan or that He's doing anything else out there. It's just to declare His glory. So when you hear about all, you know, the aliens and all that, I would be very, very skeptical of those kinds of things. They're confusing, they just distract you, and that is an admitted ploy of the devil. That's his purpose, to try and distract and confuse, and boy, that kind of stuff, people chasing UFOs and all that is nonsense. It's a waste of time. Yes, Philip. You know, I've never had it. I can give you what I would expect them to say. Although I've never had the opportunity to talk with somebody who would, you know, confront an evolutionist with that. I didn't get into it with the guy at the museum out there, although I would like to have not get into it, but, you know, discuss it with him. That's another whole story in itself. I had a really neat conversation with him. In any event, what the explanation would be that this, you'll see, this is just part of this gradual process where all the horses looked a particular way, and then some other horses developed these other characteristics, or any other kind of a creature, and then the older characteristics eventually died out, and so during that period of time, the two kinds were overlapping. That's what they would say. And, you know, that fits with the scenario of how they would put the whole gradual model together. My point in showing you those kinds of evidences is, however, that when it's displayed to us on these graphs and so forth, and they put it with the time scales and these huge vast periods of time, the fact of the matter is, in reality, it's not that way. You've got both of these horses that you saw how different they were. It wasn't just like one horse's toes were a little smaller or something. They were gone. And the one that had the toes were quite large. So this idea of gradually moving from one into another is not the case in the fossil record. And they were coexisting. And I would just submit, like I said, they're different varieties of, they're not ancestors one of another. In fact, it's obvious they aren't ancestors of one another. They're both living at the same time. But they would just say that this is two varieties that are overlapping, and the one with the toes eventually died out, and the stronger, the one that was better adapted for the plains with the hoof, you know, is what was left. So that's how they would explain it. I just want you to recognize that the way they show you these graphs and everything, it can be very deceptive as to this idea that it takes millions, 18 million for that particular scenario for these things to occur. Yes? I would point out that, and I really briefly referred to this morning, the idea of Hebrew literature, that there are certain forms that the literature will use, which is quite normal. The first few chapters of Genesis are written in a well-understood Hebrew form of literature called historical narrative. And part of the way that literature worked was, just like it had a summary sentence, and that covered the whole 7 days. That first sense of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then there was more detail giving what God did in those 7 days. Also then, very commonly, something within the more descriptive information will be of special interest. And after they get done describing those things, they'll go back inside, pick out something of real interest, pull it out, and then continue describing it. In a sense, sort of jumping back a little in time and giving us even more detail. And that is what Genesis chapter 1 and 2 are doing. Let's show you this. Genesis chapter 2 is nothing more than a much more detailed description of the sixth day of creation. Now, God gave us some information about the sixth day of creation. He started it there in verse 24 of Genesis 1 and talks about creating the land, animals. But then he gets even more specific and says, okay, and then we're going to make man. But notice what he says here in verse 27. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And that's all he says. He just says, okay, I created the land creatures, and I created male and female. I created man. And then it goes on, we get the day of rest, and we get a couple of commandments, be fruitful and multiply. But that's all we're told. Genesis 2 now goes back and says, now this is the most important thing. This is the most interesting thing. So God's going to give us more details about what he did on the sixth day. Now there's a couple things that are confusing. So let's look at them. The most confusing thing is, okay, in verse 5 it says, now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth. Now if we're just thinking chronologically, which is what our big problem always is, we as Westerners always just figure, okay, if you're going to tell me something, you always tell me what happened yesterday, and then tell me what's happening now, and then tell me what's happening tomorrow. How can you tell me what's happening tomorrow and then jump back? And now, you know, you read novels that do that, right? But Hebrew, that's the way Hebrew works. So we read, no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, no plant of the field had yet sprouted. And we go, well, wait a minute, God, way back there in Genesis chapter 1 on day 3, God created plants. So here's a mistake. See, this is a separate story, and that's what people claim. But notice that it says, no shrub of the field was yet in the earth. The Hebrew word for field is a different Hebrew word, just like we have a word, field. We can translate it that way. And a field in Hebrew is talking about a place where you grow crops. What do you grow around here? Beets, I understand. What's a field around here mean? You got beets growing in it, or wheat or something growing in it? In Indiana, if you're talking about a field, it's got corn in it. Okay? It's an agricultural piece of ground. Hebrew's got a word for field, which is an agricultural piece of land. It's got a word for dirt. It's got a word for the land. Just like we've got different words. So here where it says there's no shrub of the field, it's talking about there's no plants growing as a result of farming. And continue to read, and you'll see that he's even explained it for us. No shrub of the field was yet on the earth, no plant of the field yet sprouted. For the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground. This does not say that there were no plants. It's not a mistake. Oops, plants were created on the third day. It means that there wasn't any farming yet going on. And of course, if you continue to read, then you say, the first farmer was God. He plants a garden. He doesn't have to wait, conveniently, for the trees 20 years to start producing fruit, as is in all the rest of his miracles. Boom, there it is, and the trees are ready to produce fruit and eat. So that doesn't contradict the day's order, which is what a lot of people would claim. And the other thing that's confusing is, again, the order with animals. If you look over in Genesis chapter 2, verse 19. Now, if you have an NIV, it'll be clear. And the NIV, frankly, translates it correctly. I'm not saying that the other way is translating it incorrectly, but it makes it confusing. My version says, and out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky. Well, now, wait a minute. The birds were created on the fifth day. And we've already been told here earlier in Genesis chapter 2 that God created the man. So now we got the birds out of order. And then he's creating the beasts of the field, and we're told that first was the birds of the field, and then was man. So it seems like this chapter, again, is contradicting the order. But it is correct to translate the verb there in verse 19 this way. And out of the ground the Lord God had formed, in a past tense, had formed every beast of the field. And so all that's going on, it says, and he brought them to the man. So after he created Adam, a group of the creatures that he had created. Notice it's not all the creepy crawlies, it's not every fish in the sea or anything else, it's just a very small group, the beasts of the field, and again, that's that agricultural group of, that's that agriculture kind of a land. So we're talking about a very small subset of land creatures here. Beasts of the field, God had already created them, he brought them to Adam. Hey, how do you like this? You want to marry a, well, here's some crazy creatures, and of course Adam rejected them all wisely, and again, these sentences do not contradict the order and descriptions of Genesis chapter 1. That is why, though, when you just read it sort of quickly, and especially if you're trying to look for mistakes, you can read that and go, yeah, these things don't seem to fit, so one story is different from the other story. They contradict. You'll hear that all the time, you guys. How in the world can you believe the Bible? For goodness sakes, the first two chapters of the Bible are full of errors that contradict each other. So what's the use of reading the rest of it? Well, you know what? They don't contradict each other. It helps to have a little better understanding of Hebrew. It helps to have an understanding of Hebrew literature. And it also helps be willing to come to God's Word and say, okay, I might not understand these things, but I'm not going to use that as an excuse to then reject it. My job is to figure out, you know, what it does mean, and you'll find God is faithful, and it's all true. That's how I would say to the person that says Genesis chapter 1 and 2 contradict each other. I said that. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. Carbon, it might not work so much with carbon 14 because carbon 14 is essentially going to be a result of something that was alive. But I mean, other forms of dating, like uranium dating and argon, potassium argon, and things like that. Yeah, it is possible that their measurements are right and everything else. The assumption, again, we go back to, so what's the disagreement? How can we resolve this discrepancy? The discrepancy comes in the assumption that the old earth, the ancient universe type of person would have, and that is, this rock had to start with all just the uranium and the decay order is facing right now. I think it's like uranium-235. It all starts with uranium-235. And then the decay products all have to be a result of that. From the perspective that I would come to the Bible with, and as a young earth creationist, my perspective was, wait a minute, why couldn't God create the rock with the variety of decay elements already in place, and then it starts aging from there? We would perceive it to have been created as an old rock. Just like we would perceive Adam to be, surely he's got to be, you know, a 20, 30-year-old on Tuesday after the first creation week, but he wasn't. He just looked that way. I think there's good reason to assume that the world needs to be aged, because rocks that are not old, so to speak, where the radioactive decay hasn't sort of settled down and become more stable, are essentially unstable and very harmful to life. They produce a lot of heat, they produce a lot of radiation, and I would submit that the Lord doesn't need anything, but I mean, for His purposes, He would need an aged earth to bring life upon it. Because an unaged earth would not be suitable for life. It would be too unstable. So like rapid aging during that day, or that was a long day? Yeah. Right. The gap theory would say that all the geological ages, the millions and billions of years actually, could be inserted between day one and day two. I reject that, mostly because it's not a good interpretation of the Bible. You see, they'll translate verse 2 this way, and the earth became formless and void. Now that verb could be translated that way, but in the context that we've got here, I mean, it's really twisting it. It's every place else in the form that it is here, every place else it's just translated as was, you know, not became, this idea that's in a process of becoming something. But in order to get, you know, well, maybe we could dump evolution, you know. Well, not even evolution. I'm not going to say the gap people believe in evolution. They just are trying to explain the ages that appear to be in the star light and the earth. And they dump it all in there. But, I disagree with that. And I think that for the most part, the reason that the gap theory was ever devised, this is a couple of generations ago, was there was such pressure from the scientific community to, I mean, they didn't know all the things that we know even now. there was such pressure, they figured, man, this stuff, can all this ages of the universe everything be wrong? They must be right. And so they're just trying to figure out how can we, you know, harmonize that with what the Bible says. So they neatly tucked it all, I mean all of it, right in there between verse 1 and verse 2 of our Bible. So it was a good try, I think. But I don't think it's right. Yes, Roy. The explanations that I've gotten are that there are mechanisms that allow the salt to deposit at a rate that is close to equivalent with the rate that the salt is coming into the ocean. I've never heard an explanation describing that mechanism, but they say that must be happening, that somehow the salt is depositing into rock and so forth. That's what I've heard, but I've never heard a real good explanation of that. I've even heard some say that salt wouldn't be concentrated in the ocean, that it evaporates with evaporation. And that's just not the case. I mean, just pure water evaporates. So, but I've even heard that. Yes. Where the continents all together, that the name of that single continent they call Pangaea. I think that's a possibility. But the explanation that then the continents have been drifting apart and are now in their present positions as a result of 4 billion years of continental movement, I don't accept. One of the world's most respected geophysicists works in Los Alamos, New Mexico. His name is Dr. Baumgartner. And he has developed a computer modeling program that geologists all around the world use. It's the top-notch program to try and computer model predicting earthquakes and movement of continents and all this kind of stuff. He happens, and it grates the evolutionists I know, he happens to be a young earth creationist. And so in any of these computer modeling techniques that you use, you have to plug in certain assumptions. Okay, if this and this and this be true, plug in the data, punch the button, and now spit the computer with its answer. Okay? Well, he has devised two programs with two different sets of assumptions. Now, remember, assumptions are things you can't prove. They're just, okay, we assume conditions were like this. We weren't there. We can't prove what they were like. But if conditions were like this, what happens? Or if conditions were like this. And he, with these two different sets of assumptions, comes up with two possibilities. One, you put in the assumptions, and out comes, yep, the continents would take 4 billion years to move into the positions that they are in today. The other set of assumptions that he uses, and there's no arguing with him, the continents would take the position that they're in today in the period of 1 year. Now, how long did the flood take to recede and Noah and the animals get out of the ark? And how long? 370 days. 370 days. So what was going on when the oaks floating around on the ocean? What do you think was going on? If indeed there was a Pangaea, one giant continent, what was going on under the water was that the continents literally became plastic, it's called. The mantle underneath were just became liquid, virtually. And the continents just, and they moved and took up the present positions. The water's come back down. The ocean basins sink. And now we've got mountain ranges. We've got these fantastic canyons and everything. And the continents are all over the world instead of just one giant one. That may very well be the case. Then again, you know, we're awfully good at seeing things and trying to fit the continents together, whether there really was one continent. Neither here nor there, but I think they may very well have been. Yeah. That's a good question. Let's look over there. Peleg. Some people think that, okay, but there's a verse in the Bible that talks about Peleg, and he was born during when the earth was divided. So it sounds like, you know, okay, that's when Pangaea split apart. Peleg lived in the days, let's see, that would be 1025? Thank you. I was going to look in Genesis 5, but 1025 is the one that talks about it being divided. Thanks. Genesis 10:25, and two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg. For in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. You know, my wife wouldn't let me name my son Joktan. You guys know Luke? I think that is a cool name. Joktan, man. But Sharon would not have it, so we got Luke. What's Luke's a great name. I mean, I named my son Luke.
Okay, didn't mean to get off the subject. It says about Peleg, you see, his name means divided. Okay, he was named that before in his days the earth was divided. And so something, this is when Pangaea split up. Well, first of all, the idea of one continent rapidly, I mean the earth, just splitting apart when people were on it, is just, in my mind, untenable. A little shake and you got buildings falling and people running for their lives and they're dying. Now, imagine taking the continent and splitting it up and moving, you know, America's over here and Europe over there. Nothing could survive that kind of earthquake upheaval. Everything would be dead. And there's nothing in here about any kind of earthquakes at all. Some have attempted to this is really sort of speculative, but sort of add up the generations that are listed here in Genesis chapter 10. And Peleg, some propose, would approximately fall at the time of the Tower of Babel. And of course, we know what happened at the Tower of Babel. Do we know what happened at the Tower of Babel? All humankind were all sitting around in one city. And God said, I don't want you guys doing that. And he split them apart. And so where the earth was divided, the term earth there is often used to represent people. It's not always, this is one of the terms for dirt or ground or earth that isn't necessarily just talking about dust. It can actually talk about the people of the earth. So I would submit that in Genesis 10:25, when it talks about Peleg, and in his days the earth was divided, it's talking about the peoples of the earth were divided. He lived during the days of Nimrod. He lived during the days of the Tower of Babel. And then they spread out over the earth. And you know that little principle that I was talking about, where there'll be something interesting in a chapter, and so then the next chapter will sort of go back in and then with more detail describe just a little comment that was made. That happens here in Genesis chapter 10. Look what it says, chapter 10, verse 5. From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. And it goes on. And then we've got that verse there about Peleg. What follows in Genesis chapter 11? Story about the Tower of Babel. Well, now the Tower of Babel is a story that in time is going way back into the... way back into Genesis chapter 10. So this is something that happens a lot in the way that Hebrew literature, historical narrative especially, is written down. It's not always just, you know, day after day after day chronological. They're not all hung up on making sure everything's chronological. They're just, the way they organize their literature is a little different than we tend to organize it. One more question? Yes. Well, I think that, for example, the land bridge between Asia and North America was present at one point. So, I mean, after the continents broke up, there still was a land bridge. So even though they're separate continents, the creatures could pass back and forth. And creatures are pretty good at getting around, even when it seems to us like it would be impossible for them to get from one place to another. And I would also suggest to you again, see, there's so many assumptions that go in with this whole old earth, and man came way, way down at the very end, you know. Wouldn't man carry animals around with him? We understand that man migrates, man takes ships, and he goes here and there. And man, you see, it's so much a part of our evolutionary thinking, even when we're not one, we don't think about, now wait a minute, yeah, I mean, the animals could get all around the world simply because man was all around the world. The hippos weren't evolving and everything, and man was going to come down 30 million years later. So man could have been the basically responsible for the distribution of creatures, where it appears like, well, the only way they could have gotten from, you know, the South America area to Africa was South America and Africa had to be one chunk of land once upon a time. So whether it's man, whether there's land bridges, or whether some of the explanations by evolutionary scientists that these creatures are obviously descendants of these creatures separated by an ocean, so they must have been together, all of those things I would say are possible explanations for how we've got creatures all over the place that aren't always easy to understand why they're there. For me, the most difficult question about why kinds of creatures are where they are is Australia. I mean, why are they all just marsupials in Australia? I haven't a clue. I mean, that just is bizarre to me, but that's the way it is. You have a question, Kumaria? Go ahead. Pardon? Because this one's really messed up. And, you know, I would think that when it's talking about a new heaven and a new earth, it is talking about the material heavens and earth. So not necessarily the supernatural heaven, you know, the realm of angels and God and so forth. And that's something I think is good to keep in mind too when we consider the creation account in Genesis 1. There's nothing spiritual here. By spiritual, you know what I mean? I mean, God isn't creating spirits and stuff. He's just giving us information about the material creation, period. Some people will look at verse 3. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And since the Lamb is the light of heaven, you know, see, this is talking about Jesus Christ being created. Firstborn of creation. This is energy. This is the light that, you know, we can see and feel, and this is the material universe. So when God creates a new heaven and a new earth, I think that He's just starting over again because this one's messed up. Maybe part of the curse was God ordaining the second law of thermodynamics. Remember what that one is? Everything runs old. Everything wears out. And maybe the second law will be out of here in the new heaven and new earth. I don't know. But He just decides that rather than renovating, it's time to just redo it. With this group, I was hoping I'd get this question. Since I didn't get this question, I'm going to ask you a question. And if somebody can answer it, that'd be great. Otherwise, I'll answer it, at least from my own opinion. Because specifically for this group, who do you think, in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2, those sons of God were? Genesis chapter 6 verse 1. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And, you know what happened after that? Along comes the flood. Anybody know who those, what do you think? What are the sons of God? Yeah, Levi. Not the sons of Noah. Are they fallen angels? Is that what you think? Huh? I've heard that too. What do you think? Fallen angels. Okay? So, this is the typical, dispute. And we're not disputing here, this is interesting. You know, who are these guys? The sons of God. Are they angels? And if they are angels, they're fallen angels. I mean, they're demons. They're not supposed to be coming down and taking women and stuff. Or are they men? I used to think that they were angels. And a lot of fine Christians believe they're angels. And there's some verses in Jude and in Peter and places where it seems like maybe that's what's being described there. But I've come to the place where I don't think they are angels. I do indeed think they are human beings for these reasons. One. I already stressed this morning how an angel is purely a spiritual being. I mean, there are no body parts. There's nothing material about them. So the idea of an angel having children with a human being is simply impossible. I mean, it just doesn't work. It cannot be. Now you get the idea, well, maybe there was demon possession and so forth. But still, the idea especially that gives people the sense that these sons of God are talking about demons, angelic beings, really, I think, comes in verse 4. Because, okay, so you got in your mind that there's these demon-like creatures and they're having children with human beings and they're producing weird offspring. Verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Somebody with the King James, what does it say about verse 4? What does it say right there in the beginning? What were they? Giants. And so, you see, you know, okay, you got demons and they're having babies with women and they're making giants and the world gets so bad that God has to destroy it. Well, that's a nice picture, but I think there's a real problem with this, you know, demons, angels don't have any genetics. And so, you know, you're not going to get giants, you're not going to get amoebas, you're not going to get anything. The term giants there comes from Numbers chapter 13, verse 33. Look over there. Numbers 13, 33. Why can't I find Numbers? There it is. Somebody with a King James read it for me, and then I'm going to read it out of the New American Standard. Numbers 13, 33. Okay. Notice that what the King James does is whenever the Hebrew word Nephilim, that if you take the Hebrew and just pronounce it, it's Nephilim. Wherever Nephilim are, they'll translate it giant. And that is because, remember who Anak was? Goliath was a son of Anak. So Goliath was a giant. And so part of the family members, one of the tribes maybe or something, of the Nephilim were giants. But Nephilim does not, by definition, have to mean giants. So there's a sense that, oh, well, see, you know, Goliath, he was a giant, and he was the son of Anak, and he was part of the Nephilim, so Nephilim must mean giants. I submit to you that that isn't necessarily the case at all. We are told what the Nephilim are. Back here in Genesis 6, it says that they married, the sons of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Now, we get a description of who the Nephilim are. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So picture what it was like in these days. You've got the big shots, the princes, the guys in charge. And of course they've got beautiful daughters and they've got big palaces and everything's great, you know. And the sons of God, who I interpret to be the people that are descended from Seth. Actually, from Enosh, if you go back to Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, it says, "And to Seth and to him and also a son was born. He called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord." And we've got a lineage in Genesis chapter 5 of the line from Enosh all the way to Noah. I submit to you that, of course, they're having lots of sons and daughters, and there's a group of people that are God's people. They're the sons of God, the children of God. All right? And what happens? Wow. The sons of God, they start looking at the daughters of men and look pretty good. And, you know, dad's got a lot of dough. And dad's got a big kingdom over here. And what was going on, you guys? I'm spending all this time because it is a crucial application for our Christian life. And I see this beginning here in Genesis 6, and God hammers away at it through the whole Bible. What was going on here? God's people were intermarrying. Sorry, brother, go ahead. Right. God's people were intermarrying with the unbelievers. We can't blame it on demons. God's people were marrying unbelievers, and the world got so bad that God wished he had never even done it. And there was one person left from the line of Enosh. His name is Noah. And God wiped them all out. God had some strict rules for the Jews too, didn't he? About intermarrying. And God's got some strict rules for the church. And you guys, we are in days not quite like Noah's yet. But the more we ignore this stuff and go and say, yeah, she's hot. And she's got a lot to offer. She's okay. She'll be all right. Or ladies, I don't know if I'll ever find a guy. So, you know, I know he's not saved, but God will save me someday. And you don't trust God for your partner. And you intermarry. We'll find ourselves in the days of Noah. And God will come back. And maybe he'll take you out like he took Lot out. But you know what? We need to be better than this. And we need to learn from the lessons of history. God has been struggling with this, with his people, since the very beginning. For goodness sakes, if you ask me, it looks to me like it was the cause of the flood. God's people intermarrying. I can't stress enough to you young people. as you're, you know, it's important. You know, I know y'all, most of you, maybe some that are gifted to not want a spouse, but so many of you, you know, it's important. You want a husband, you want a wife, you want a partner. And it's the wonderfulest thing to want. I mean, God created us this way. But you've got to be strong and faithful and trust the Lord and marry a believer. You're not going to marry a perfect person, but marry a believer. And avoid just a colossal mess in your married life. Yeah, brother. And so, all that to say, who are the sons of God? I think, and there's disagreement about this, and it's not a huge, you know, doctrinal thing, but I just see that there's a theme through the Bible, and it starts here. I think the sons of God were the children of God in the line of Enosh, and there were some terrible things that happened as a result of God's people being diluted out to down to one. All right, well, do we go to like 3:30 or should we just stop now? I get to decide. All right. Well, let's get a couple more days under our belt. What we'll do is, I know what we'll do. We'll finish, because I really didn't even finish Genesis the first day, did I? So we'll do that and we'll certainly be done by 3:30, okay? When we considered these first two verses in Genesis chapter 1, basically what we had seen God do was create matter out of nothing. You know what that word is? Ex nihilo, out of nothing. That's what God did here. He created the matter of the substance of the earth. But that's not all he did on this first day. Look at verse 3. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning one day. So now we see after God created the substance, the matter of the earth, he creates light. Now what is light? Well, light, you know, is this stuff that we can see. But there's a lot of light that you can't see. You're getting warmer and warmer as we sit here in close quarters. That's light. What kind of light is it? Infrared light, right? And you can put goggles on, you get these fancy goggles, and you can see it. There's ultraviolet light, another form of light that we can't see, but insects can see it, kestrels can see it. There are lots of different kinds of creatures that can see ultraviolet light. And then there's a whole spectrum of other forms of light that nothing can see, but are essentially what we would call electromagnetic radiation, energy. So I submit to you that what God does here in verse 3 on the first day of creation is he creates the energy that we describe as light. And so here, with a word, God creates the energy of the universe. He's created the earth. He's created matter and energy out of nothing. And in so doing, as I've also already mentioned, I submit to you that God created time. Einstein's little theory that has had a magnificent impact. I mean, it's been wonderful. It's helped our, and then in another way, it's not been the greatest thing with atomic bombs and everything, but his little formula, what is it? E equals mc squared? What do those terms mean? E is energy. Most common form, we'd say, you know, electromagnetic radiation. E, energy, equals m, which is a term for mass, which is the earth stuff, the substance of the earth. So energy equals mass times c squared. Well, that's an odd little deal. What's c squared? C squared has as one of the units the term for time, seconds. C stands for 186,000 miles per second. It's supposed to represent a constant speed for light in a vacuum. There's some debate about that, whether light speed really is constant in a vacuum. Oh, now, you know, oh no. Light can be slowed down, you can send it through water, or, you know, have you read that they stopped light through these sodium wafers? Stopped it. By the way, you know what they're saying? Okay, so that's an interesting experiment in a lab, but what might it mean to me? It might very well mean to you that just as, and you guys don't even know what tubes are. Radio tubes? Some of the folks know what radio tubes are. The extent to which electronics took a jump in advance from tubes to diodes, semiconductors, they are saying is the same kind of jump that is going to take place from semiconductors to having little photon stoppers and goers, because, you know, the digital is just on or off. How about taking one photon, stopping it, letting it go through a little chip? And they're saying that once they get this perfected now, you think computers are fast now? So anyway, we're describing, the speed of light is being constant in a vacuum, and we can slow it down, but there's a constant speed at which it can go in a vacuum. Well, there are theories that are being developed that say no, the force of gravity seems to have an effect on the speed of light. And what is space mostly made of? That's sort of not the right way to say it. What is the universe mostly made of? Huh? Empty space. I mean, really empty space. Not even the kind of empty space between stars and the galaxy. But between the galaxies, I mean, the universe is, there's nothing there. It's empty. And there's no gravity there either, because the gravity is only coming from the stars. And the theory goes that, in fact, light's speed may be infinite. So 186,000 miles per second is like a tortoise compared to just being here from there. And so, in fact, light may literally just jump instantaneously from one galaxy to the next. Boy, what would that do then in trying to figure out how long it took for the light to get here from Andromeda? And well, let's see, Andromeda, I don't even know how far away it is. I think it's supposed to be 1.4 light years or something. Well, maybe it didn't take 1.4 years for the light to get here. It may have just jumped here from Andromeda. So, like, beam me up, Scotty. You know? So all these assumptions that we make we know that star is 14 billion light years away by definition, then that means the universe has got to be 14 billion years old because it took that long for the light that I'm seeing twinkle in my eye to get here. Well, not necessarily. For one thing, God could have just created the star with the light intact, and for another thing, maybe we don't know all there is to know about the speed of light. What's the biggest vacuum we ever made? Have we ever made a vacuum as big as this room and then tested the speed of light? Have we made a vacuum as big as the state as North Dakota and tested the speed of light? I don't think so. And we're talking about taking these measurements and then extrapolating that to umpteen trillions of miles. Well, sure, it's constant over vacuum space. God created the light of the universe, the energy of the universe. He created the matter of the universe, and in so doing, He created time. E equals mc squared. You see, in that little formula, there's no such thing in our reality, the physical reality, of having energy and matter without time, or having matter without energy and time. There's no such thing as any one without the other two. They are completely interrelated. And so, by virtue of the fact that God created matter and energy, He created time. He started it right then. What was going on before then? Well, it was before time, like that little verse we read in Jude. And the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit were surely in fellowship and planning and deciding, you know, before the foundation of the earth. They decided to plan, they chose you, they developed the plan of salvation, and I'm sure God planned out, you know, how He was going to put Adam together. There probably would have been a million different ways He could have decided to, you know, you ever watch Star Trek? You know, why isn't life silicon-based instead of carbon-based? I bet you God could have made it silicon-based life if He wanted. But He chose to do it this way, and all that kind of stuff is going on before then God goes, let there be light. God created time. That's important to remember, you guys, because we get hung up on time. And God is just above it. You know, there's a verse in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 chapter 3, verse 8. A lot of people like to use this verse and say, hey, now wait a minute. See, this verse even says that a day doesn't mean a day. So when you get to the end of every day in Genesis chapter 1, and it says there was an evening and a morning, a second day or whatever, well, that doesn't mean a day. It doesn't mean 24 hours. And so somehow we can squeeze a bunch of time in there that way. Let's look at what 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8 says. It says, do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. What does the word day mean in that verse? It means 24 hours, doesn't it? I mean, literally, if we were going to translate this as carefully to make sure that there's no mistake about what's being said here, we would translate it this way. But don't let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord, 24 hours is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like 24 hours. I mean, that's the meaning of the word day there in that verse. Now, day can mean different periods of time in the Hebrew. Just like when we use the word day, it can mean different periods of time. But it can also mean a 24-hour period. And virtually always, if there's a number describing it, like there's one day or 20 days or 370 days, then we're talking about the earth rotating on its axis. So, you know, I reject this idea that this verse somehow means that we can take the word day in Genesis 1 and say it doesn't mean 24 hours. But what is the verse really getting at? This isn't a proof text to prove that, you know, the word day means 24 hours in Genesis 1. There's another reason for the verse being here, and this is what the reason is. It's telling us that with God, a day, which sometimes is a big deal to us, and sometimes we can forget them day after day, God doesn't look at a day the same way as you and I. For example, you know, when the scientist who's going to reject, you know, God can be involved, so how in the world are we going to get life on this planet? How are we going to get the universe to take the shape that it's in? Well, first of all, it seems to me it's going to take a long time. So, you know, what God did in a day, it may seem to us like, well, this ought to take thousands. No, millions. No, billions of years. But God isn't, you know, wrapped up in that stuff. He's not bound by the time that He created, for goodness sakes. And so what appears to us, it's going to take a real, real long time. God just does it like that. That's how great our God is. But on the other hand, 1,000 years. A day is like 1,000 years. It's a day. Have you ever had a day in your life that seemed like it would never end? Yeah, our perception is sort of relative. How about God? Was there ever a time when a day was 1,000 years or more for Him? How about the day that the Lord Jesus hung on the cross? It was just a few hours. And people that would have seen the Lord hanging there, didn't know who He was, felt pity for him. Man, you know, that's just tragic. I feel so sorry, but you know, he'll be dead in a few hours and he'll be in a better place or whatever they might say, having no clue that the God of the universe is accomplishing an eternity of work in those few hours. See, God doesn't need big, big, long periods of time. And sometimes He does unbelievably fantastic things in the shortest period of time. The point is, you guys, God isn't just, He's not entrapped by it. He's not all hung up by it. His perception of time and His use of time is just different than ours. And one of the ways that we could help ourselves become more like Christ, I suggest, is that we grasp and we take in our own being a little more understanding of the way God looks at time and the way we live our lives. It might seem like, man, that'd be a long time to wait for the right person. It's just a drop in the bucket. Or we might wish that God would hurry up and get me through this school or get me out of this sickness or hurry up and you know, Lord, I just wish that You'd change this person. You know, the passage goes on to say, the Lord isn't slow about His promise, as we count slowness, but He's patient towards you, not wishing for any to perish. He's been patient towards you. He's been patient towards me. Sometimes we may wish that God would, oh, just let me live a few more days, Lord. Give me a little more time. We're just hung up on it, aren't we? And if we can just have the mind of Christ a little more in our perspective on time, I think we'd all be better off. I know we'd all be better off. It would affect patience. I fully think that it would affect kindness. It would affect faithfulness. It's a real comfort to know that God is in control of time and God is not controlled by time. We will have eternity, you guys. Eternity. Can't imagine it, but we will have eternity to get to know each other better, to walk with the Lord. It's going to be great. It's really going to be great. And so what's going on now? Right now, what we have is the opportunity to use a few years, maybe a bunch of years, to truly put